Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, November 17th, 2016. Lots of news to comment on today, and our lead story, well, it invites a little victory dance. The proven perjurer and top spook in the United States intelligence community has announced his resignation. General James Clapper, who has been the Director of National Intelligence since Obama appointed him in 2010, announced that he will be leaving office when Obama steps down on the 20th of January. Now, this is significant because Obama should have fired this guy a long time ago. He lied. He lied under oath. And his lie under oath, his perjury, was described by Edward Snowden as the triggering point. What made him decide to go forward with his plan to leak secret documents to Glenn Greenwald and others? And I think it's really significant that Obama held on to him. Was it because Clapper had leverage on Obama? An intercepted phone call or a videotape of something that could embarrass the president? I don't know. But it does really beg the question. And James Clapper, when he rose to his job back in 2014, he played a leading role in firing Mike Flynn. Mike Flynn was running the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he is now a top intelligence advisor and may replace Clapper under the Trump administration. And in some ways, that's the change of the guard as it occurs in this country. Not much of a change, if you ask me. And I was shocked to see Adam Schiff, a Democrat who sits on the House Intelligence Committee, a pretty smart guy from the Los Angeles area, joked when Clapper announced yesterday he'd be stepping down that he wanted him to stay for four years extra. Where the hell does that come from? So I'm happy to see him go. But I think that we all have to hold our breath, because typically when a bad, bad person leaves Washington, they're replaced by someone even worse. Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democratic senator who asked the question that led to Clapper's lie, said that during his tenure, senior intelligence officials engaged in a deception spree regarding mass surveillance. Top officials, officials who reported to Clapper, repeatedly misled the American people and even lied to them. Regardless of what was going on through the director's head when he testified, he has later said, oh, he forgot. But Wyden points out, failing to correct the record was a deliberate decision to lie to the American people about what their government was doing. That same Ron Wyden sat down for an interview with our friend and colleague Jason Leopold at Vice News. And he had some interesting comments on what he has in store in terms of taking on the Trump administration over surveillance, torture, and related issues.
What's your plan for battling the Trump administration, given that you are in a minority?
I've always, whether I'm in the majority or in the minority, have said there are core values, their core American values, their core Oregon values. And I'm going to fight for those values no matter who's in the majority and who's in the minority. What I'll do if, for example, we saw the president-elect say during the campaign that, in effect, he was for the FBI's idea of forcing companies to build back doors into their products. I think that would be a mistake from a security standpoint. I think it'd be a mistake from a liberty standpoint. And I've already indicated that if there's an effort to pursue that, I will go to the floor of the United States Senate and I will filibuster that legislation.
He also mentioned on the campaign trail that he would be all for returning to a policy of torture, which you spent quite a bit of time on with the Senate in putting together this report about the CIA's torture program. Are we getting back into an area of secret law that we saw during the Bush administration years?
Having essentially defined secret law, because I went to the floor of the Senate several years, for example, before the Snowden disclosures, and I said, let me outline the problem of secret law. We have members of the intelligence community and the law enforcement community saying one thing in public and another thing in private. And I spent months and months trying to lay out how that was unacceptable. And when Mr. Clapper came to an open hearing, I asked him, does the government collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? And his statement was a lie.
This was a very notable exchange that you had. We've seen it on news reports where you have confronted the Director of National Intelligence about this.
And I will continue to ask the tough questions. You
know. So that's Senator Ron Wyden. I've linked to the full video interview at Vice News so that you can watch it at your convenience. And there is some news about surveillance over at The Intercept. Ryan Gallagher and Enrique Moltke have co-authored a piece that exposes a building in downtown Manhattan, in Lower Manhattan, and the facility is owned by AT&T. It is located at 33 Thomas Street. It is a 29-story building with no windows, and it is called the Long Lines Building. It is a switch. That is where circuits come in with calls from overseas and from around the country and are switched to local centers so that they can be distributed to the end caller, the person being called. And these switches are the points where the NSA has inserted these diversion systems that allow them to capture all of the traffic passing through these buildings. It was Mark Klein, the courageous former AT&T technician, who revealed this about an AT&T building on Folsom Street here in San Francisco more than 10 years ago. And so this is this building called Project X is the subject of a new short film by Laura Poitras and Enrique Moltke. And it shows that Ed Snowden's documents, which don't specifically identify the building, nevertheless can be used to infer that this is the location of a codenamed installation called Titan Point. And this is where they can tap into cell phone calls, faxes, internet data, and voice calls as they cross through these important switching systems. So this tells us something more about the pervasiveness of NSA surveillance of Americans, most of whom we can presume are innocent, like you and me. Also on the surveillance beat yesterday, I told you about the Android phones and burner phones, disposable phones, that sent copies of your text messages to a server in China. Well, today we learn that Apple, despite its public efforts to protect its iPhone users with encryption, it turns out that Apple has an internal system that causes mobile devices to automatically send our call history to the company's servers if you have enabled iCloud. And this is interesting because I have resisted using iCloud to store photos and big files and things like that because I just don't trust it. The whole cloud metaphor makes it seem, you know, safe and fresh and all that. But there's no cloud. These are just server farms that are located very much on terra firma. So it turns out that Apple is collecting this data, that users are not informed when the call logs are uploaded to iCloud, and that this collection goes back to at least March of 2015, when iOS 8.2 was introduced. And starting with the latest system, iOS 10, incoming missed calls that are made through applications like Skype, WhatsApp, and Viber are captured and logged. And we know that FaceTime communications have been captured and logged. Now, Apple says that, gosh, you know, this is encrypted. It requires the user's Apple ID and password for someone to intercept it and be able to understand it. And they also say that this is part of their user verification service to make sure that everything works right. But It is vulnerable because the information is kept for at least 4 months, and that enables the government to take out a warrant, a national security letter, or just lean on the companies, like they have so many times in the past. I want to acknowledge and thank my friend Nancy Walton, who sent me this video from Standing Rock, North Dakota. You're about to hear the voice of a Native American whose name is Candida Kingbird, and she reports on some troubling aerial activity over the protesters' campsites.
Recording from Standing Rock, North Dakota, today is November 14, 2016. New developments, we have had aircraft flying over our camp for several days, different kinds of small charter planes and what looks appears to be helicopters, coming through at night. They mostly come at night and they have their lights off, which is dangerous to other aircraft. They're using the space illegally. They don't have any permits or permission to be using the airspace above federal tribal land, so they're breaking the law to begin with. Last night, the new development was that there was an aircraft flying over camp, our encampment, from approximately 1:40 a.m. till about 2:20 a.m. this morning. Every 2 minutes on the dot, they were encircling the circumference of our camp and doing what we believe to be spraying chemical agents down on top of us. This is an act of chemical warfare. This is an act of terrorism in the United States by the United States government against the indigenous peoples of Standing Rock and of this encampment. They are not.
So we have this report, which I consider to be credible. What we don't know is what nature of chemicals are being sprayed. And we don't have any further details beyond this eyewitness account. I take this very seriously. And if local law enforcement, state agencies, or federal agencies, or the private goons hired by the pipeline company, if they are spraying anything other than water on the people at the protest campsite, this is a very serious issue, and I hope that you will spread the word, demand a full investigation, and we need to get to the bottom of this. It's extremely troubling to imagine that the use of chemicals in a weapon form, and that makes them chemical weapons, would be used on First Amendment protesters, aren't unarmed people who are standing their ground on Native American land. And I found online an interesting report from the Just Security website that is run by the New York University Law School. And this is a report written by Maylin Fidler and Colin Anderson. And it's lengthy, and I've linked to it so that you can read it for yourselves. But it is a recap of the various surveillance tactics that are being used on the protesters at Standing Rock. And the aerial surveillance is one issue that they talk about, including helicopter surveillance. An aircraft flying over the protest camps carried an altered FAA registration number, which is a federal crime punishable by up to 3 years in prison. A document, they're attempting to find out who owns that aircraft with the modified FAA number, and they haven't been able to run that down yet. Then they ask about surveillance equipment like Stingray, the cell phone surveillance system that is used by the federal government and has been pushed out to many local law enforcement agencies. And while they cannot conclude definitively that Stingrays have been used, they know that states that have loaned officers and equipment to North Dakota, including Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Indiana, do have Stingray devices. So it is entirely possible that that's going on. Also, monitoring of Facebook check-ins using tools like Geofedia, that appears to be going on, and it caused many sympathizers around the nation, people who support the protests, to log in by saying that they were at Standing Rock in an effort to throw off those who might be monitoring Facebook accounts. Today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with Pepe Escobar to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com. Pepe is the colorful Brazilian who travels the world, and I always value his offshore perspective. And today we talk about the rise of Trump, the recent presidential election, including the claims that Russia was responsible for the hacking and the transfer of information to WikiLeaks. And Pepe has a lot of smart commentary. Here's an excerpt where he comments on Donald Trump's unique style of speech and how it matches short attention spans, people with limited information, and those who are fond of Twitter.
The way he did not use the English language for me was particularly extremely impressive. He was speaking like a fourth grader or maybe a fifth grader.
Wrong.
His vocabulary. Yeah.
Wrong. You're a loser. You're low energy.
Exactly. And with a vocabulary of roughly 50 to 60 words. Mm-hmm. Repeated ad infinitum. And with lots of terminological shortcuts, metaphors, euphemisms, repetition, a controlled stuttering. It was absolutely fascinating. A linguistic analysis of an in-depth linguistic analysis of Trump would be so. I haven't seen one yet in detail. I tried to just single out some details in a column, but this is worth a 300-page essay. This was fascinating. And the way the whole thing connected. Because, with a simple Twitter of 20 words, he would get much more attention than anybody on all cable, all networks, all the big newspapers, very, very easily. And, when you see that he has, apparently the right numbers is around 28 million followers combined on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You don't need networks. You don't need New York Times. You don't need the neocons in the editorial pages of the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal.
I invite you to check out the full interview with Pepe Escobar. He's got a lot to say. It's available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And those include people like Andy Krieger, a new subscriber, Mario Salinas, has checked in recently. Grant Gibson and Joe Carson are two stalwart supporters of this podcast, and I invite you to join them. I need your support to keep this machine going. In fact, I need to inform you that next week I'll bring you a podcast on Tuesday, and then I'm taking the rest of Thanksgiving week off. And I'm in the process of moving my secret studio to a new location across town. And it's going to give me better facilities to record my podcasts and interviews. And there is a cost associated with that. It costs money to move. In the end, I hope to save money by sharing rent with an office partner. But if you'd like to help out with the move, I would really appreciate that. You can make a one-time contribution. You can sign up for a new subscription of $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. Whatever you'd like to do, I very much appreciate it. All the details are on my website at peterbcollins.com. Yesterday, and actually most of this week, I've been trying to raise attention about the deep conflicts of interest posed by Donald Trump's business interests and his failure to insulate himself from what are clear conflicts of interest. And we've also talked about the claim that he wanted top security clearances for his three adult children and his son-in-law. And we talked about Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, whose father was a real estate mogul who was prosecuted by Chris Christie and sent to prison. And Jared Kushner is looking for ways around the laws, the federal nepotism laws, that would prevent him from joining the administration. And the New York Times reports that Kushner has consulted with at least one lawyer and believes that by foregoing a salary and putting his own investment fund, real estate holdings, and his newspaper, the New York Observer, into a blind trust, that he would not be bound by federal nepotism rules. He'd just be a world-class volunteer, right? But under federal statute, the president cannot accept voluntary services that are not permitted by law. And a separate statute bars public officials from employing family members in any capacity. So I think these are important issues. And if Hillary Clinton had become the winner of the presidential race, and I'm choosing my words carefully because I still believe that it was rigged and that Clinton was, in fact, the winner. But had she prevailed, I would be asking these same questions about the conflicts posed by the Clinton Foundation. And so I think this is really critical, and it's quite disappointing that this question was never raised in the debates with either candidate, and you only saw them asked a few questions in media interviews that they batted aside. No one ever has really demanded that Trump explain how he will separate himself from his self-interest if he becomes president. So Democrats in the Senate appear to have an interesting strategy. Instead of what the Republicans did in 2009, announcing that they would block Obama at every step and try to make him a one-term president, the Dems in the Senate are saying, well, let's see if we can find common ground on infrastructure spending, child tax credits, paid maternity leave, that's Ivanka's favorite subject, and dismantling trade agreements. And is there a way that Democrats can forge some working relationship with Trump around those issues? And I'm doubtful. I really am. But I think this is a smart political move of the Democrats to at least attempt to work with Trump. And while we can anticipate that they won't be obstructing him on day one, well, maybe by day five, they will reach that point. Interesting commentary on these issues from Zephyr Teachout, who ran for Congress in New York, and I frankly don't know if she prevailed or not. She is a university professor, and she writes about the Constitution's Emoluments Clause and how it would put Donald Trump in violation of the Constitution as his business holdings are currently managed. She writes, several provisions of the Constitution were designed assuming that foreign powers would actively try to gain influence. Trump may be on the verge of violating one of them, known as the Emoluments Clause. It is essentially an anti-bribery rule which forbids public servants from accepting anything of value from foreign powers without explicit congressional approval. Quote, no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And because Trump has business dealings, the Bank of China has a loan on one of his buildings in New York City, for example, these are very clear conflicts that do rise to the language of the Emoluments Clause. So we'll keep the pressure on that and try to keep focused on it as the beautiful transition proceeds so smoothly. Now I'm about to violate a pledge I made not to talk about every name that pops up for the cabinet of Donald Trump. But the latest one I cannot resist commenting on. The discussion is that David Petraeus, the disgraced Army general and CIA director who was prosecuted for mishandling classified information, has entered the race to become Trump's Secretary of State. Now, this is the failed architect of the surge in Iraq, and he was then the failed director of the surge in Afghanistan. And to imagine that Donald Trump is going to turn to him for counterinsurgency and other advice, and to turn a general and a spy into a diplomat and make him Secretary of State? That's pretty outrageous. Alan Grayson is the fiery Florida congressman who gave up his congressional seat to run for the Senate race and lost in the primary to the corporate tool Patrick Murphy, who in turn lost in the general election to Marco Rubio. So Alan Grayson is on his way out of Washington again, and I predict he'll try to come back. And as a parting shot, he has authored the None of the Above Act, None of the Above Act, or NOTA. It would require that a new special election be held whenever voters don't like the candidates and prefer none of the above. And Grayson actually paid to conduct a national poll of 1,600 registered voters right before the November election. And there were more people voting for none of the above than either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. It was 40% for NOTA, 30% for Hillary, and 27% for Trump. Grayson refers to it as voting with your middle finger. Well, the Erdogan government in Turkey is cracking down even further, and today we announced that 120 journalists have been locked up in Turkey's jails. And one of them, for example, wrote a column noting that the president of Turkey, Erdogan, hates cigarettes so much that he confiscates the packs of cigarettes from his followers and lectures them on the evils of smoking. So a columnist named Kadri Gürsel urged his readers to protest the president's anti-democratic ways by lighting a cigarette and not putting it out. Well, he's in jail for that. And there are other colleagues from his newspaper, Cum Hiriet, 10 of them, including the editor and the paper's chief executive, who are now behind bars as well. And so the lockdown, the conversion to a complete dictatorship in Turkey, is almost complete. And we haven't heard a peep out of Washington, Democrats, Republicans, the president, the media. Nope, they really sit silently by, just like Egypt, as I pointed out the other day. And finally, I want to commend the New York Times for a strong editorial condemning the moves in Israel in the Knesset, which would retroactively legalize illegal settlements built on private Palestinian land in the West Bank. This is intended to prevent a court-ordered demolition of an illegal outpost before the end of the year. And this bill is so extreme that even Netanyahu and his right-wing defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, oppose it. But an even further extreme guy, Naftali Bennett, the education minister, has said that the era of the Palestinian state is over, and they basically just want to rewrite the law to make what was clearly illegal now legal. Voila. And they're expecting the new president named Trump to say, oh yeah, that's fine, no problem here. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast. It's now available every day on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you.